This week on Life and Faith.
You're growing up too fast. 10-year-olds shouldn't be celebrating war and talking politics.
Hi, Hitler.
I wish more of our young boys had your blind fanaticism.
So, we begin. From now on, we are alone.
Pass the information, join the free press. Kill it, kill Hitler.
We're killing innocent people. Raiding other countries, preying on the weak.
If our leaders, if they're evil, what does one do?
We have entered into an amusing ourselves to death moment in history.
It doesn't make sense to me. If there is God, God's supposed to be free.
I was 100% sure that I was sacrificing on the altar of truth my only chance for happiness in this world.
Miracles don't necessarily change anybody's mind. It just gets their attention.
And so I had to run with my child on my back, the ISA army coming behind us.
I said, gee, Uncle George, this is luxurious for a communist. Son, he said, nothing's too good for the worker, nothing.
Welcome to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. I'm Simon Smart, and I'm with Justine Toe in the studio. And it's Oscar season, Justine, and we're talking summer films. You've seen a few, haven't you, lately?
I have. I've seen Parasite, which is a Korean film about class and is really quite affecting, and I really liked it.
Yeah, I heard good things about it.
Yeah, no, it's really worth seeing. And also, I've seen Knives Out, which was a lot of fun. I think you've seen this, but
seen
didn't
it.
Like
yeah,
it.
I didn't love it.
Yeah, that's hilarious.
I was annoyed by it. It was okay.
No. I thought it was wonderful. It made me realize on what humble fare I've been, you know, dining on cinema wise. When I saw a film like that, I was like, oh, this is really good, a really good film.
This is why you go to the movies.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, okay. Well, I've seen a few as well. I saw Little Women.
Did you like that?
Yeah, I did. It was good. Really good, actually.
You're part of maybe five men who went to see it. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. So The Irishman, which was
no interest, I have
hardcore.
To admit.
But today, Justin, we're going to talk about three stories, two films that came out recently and another from a couple of years ago, and all three deal with similar subject matter, and that is life within Nazi Germany, or Austria in one case, and people's response to this, and it seems to be a bit of the thing at the moment. There's lots of these films around. But it's not only the subject matter, but I have to say key themes that I want to talk about today that are in all three.
Now, obviously, I think it's worth mentioning that we are going to be dropping a spoiler or two here and there, but definitely not something that's going to ruin your experience of watching the film if you haven't seen it before. So rest assured, you're in good hands.
Here's Marshal Jojo. You're a top man. Prepare to leave the house.
Today you boys will be involved in such activities as war games, ambush techniques, Zimbleinstaffer.
I don't think I can do this.
Was? Of course you can.
First up is Jojo Rabbit, which I've actually seen as well. This is from New Zealand director Taika Waititi, who's made some great films. Hunt for the Wilder People, Boy, he's the director also of Thor Ragnarok, and also What We Do in the Shadows, that wonderful mockumentary.
For Jojo Rabbit, Scarlett Johansson is in this one. So is Rebel Wilson. These are familiar names. It's a satirical black comedy about a 10-year-old boy in Nazi Germany who is committed to the cause. He's a member of Hitler Youth, and he wants to fulfill all the ambitions that the party would have for someone like him. Now, Justine, you weren't especially taken with this one, were you?
No, I have to admit. It was a bit too quirky for me. It reminded me a lot of Wes Anderson's style, and that style tends to grate on me, I have to admit, which is a shame. I mean, I love the director, Taika Waititi. I find his work really interesting. I mean, the fact that he's also a Polynesian Jew and has called out New Zealand for being a racist place at times, I mean, all of this adds certain dimensions of interest to me because, you know, he's obviously experienced prejudice and racism himself. And so I think that finds its way into this film very powerfully. So I really wanted to like this film, but I didn't love it, I have to admit. And I also didn't find it that funny, which in some ways may be fitting. You know, do we really want a film like this to be laugh out loud funny? And I also guess it's always potentially risky to make jokes around such a sensitive topic like this.
It sure is. And different from you, I loved this film. I think I had low expectations, but I really liked it. I thought There were so many ways this film could have gotten it wrong, but I didn't think they did. I thought they sort of nailed it. One thing about this was interesting for me was that being from the perspective of a little boy, I think helps with this film. It gives an innocence to what's going on in this terrible war-torn Germany. The situation's really grim and things are falling apart. But it's the innocence of childhood that kind of reveals the craziness of the adults, if you like.
You know what I am? Say it. A Jew. Gesundheit.
Sheesh, that was intense.
What am I going to do?
No idea.
Got it. I will negotiate.
Burn down the house and blame Winston Churchill. We'll negotiate.
If I tell on you, you'll be in big trouble.
For those who don't know, Jojo has this imaginary friend. It turns out it's Hitler. Hitler, in this case, is a kind of a dandy, idiotic version of that character. And it's played by Waititi. He does this very well. I think it's a centerpiece of the story. Not easy to get right, but I think he does. But things take a really strange turn for Jojo when he discovers that his mum, Scarlett Johansson, is harboring a Jewish girl in their house.
Yeah, you can imagine his shock, because up till now, he thinks that all Jews have horns and are evil. I mean, this is all he's been told. And so it's shocking for him to be confronted with her. She's living in the walls of his house. But then as he gets to know her, all his perceptions start to unravel. And it makes me think also, you know, what a delicate juggle for the mum. I mean, Jojo's been brainwashed by the Nazis. And while he's an innocent boy, he is spouting all these lines he's been fed. And yet she, as the mother, has to kind of set that to the side and go, okay, he's just gone on this crazy, he's been brainwashed. But she just has to get on with doing what she thinks is right. And I found her performance, Scarlett Johansson's, really beautiful.
Yeah,
I'm used to seeing her in Marvel mode where she's a secret agent. Apparently she's amazing in Marriage Story. I don't know. I haven't seen it and I can't bear to watch it. But I think that she was so wonderful in this film. She got to juggle so many things, right? She's this single parent because the father is away somewhere else, and a devoted mother to this boy who, as I said, has been brainwashed. She's also hiding an enemy of the state, and she daily walks past people who've been executed. And so she's seeing before her each day the consequences of what will happen to her if she also gets caught.
Yeah, there's this line in the film where she's walking along with the little boy and there's a whole group of people who've been hanged. And he says to her, what do they do? And she just says, they did what they could. It's a beautiful line.
It's very short, but it speaks volumes, doesn't it?
They did what they could. It's not triumphant. It's not glorious, anything but. But there's a strong sense that these people were on the side of what's good and true. And this raises a really important theme that I want to talk about today, the cost of doing what's right.
Your mother took me in. She's kind. She treats me like a person.
You two seem to be getting on well.
She doesn't seem like a bad person. I'm the enemy. You're not a Nazi, Jojo. You're a 10-year-old kid who likes dressing up in a funny uniform and wants to be part of a club.
I thought it'd be great to speak to Alyssa Wilkinson. She's a friend of Life and Faith. We've had her on the program before. And she's also a film critic with Vox. She's also written about Jojo Rabbit. And so we got her on the phone from New York to get her thoughts on the film.
I think what Jojo Rabbit is about is thinking about the kind of silliness that masks the seriousness of authoritarian regimes, of groups of people who try to denigrate, you know, the dignity of other groups of people. It also underlines sort of the ludicrousness of that point of view, that there's, you know, groups of people who are somehow less worthy of human dignity than others.
What do you make of Scarlett Johansson's performance as well as character?
Yes, I think it's a great performance, actually. It's a very sympathetic performance, and it's very revealing, I think, of the conflict that she feels, because she's a mother, obviously. She's caring for her son. She also is caring for a son who, you know, kind of believes in things that she doesn't, and yet she wants him to kind of come to these convictions herself, while also doing these, you know, this important act that she's doing of protecting people who are being hunted down for their lives. So I think her performance is great, and I also really enjoyed watching her. And I also, you know, there are scenes that in that movie that really are heartbreaking to me, because it's reminding us that again, you know, small heroes, ordinary people doing ordinary things and paying the consequences for them, they're still the people that, you know, kind of make the world a place that we feel like we can live in. And we're ordinary people too, and like, we might be asked to do those kinds of things, and will we be brave enough to do them, even if we think nobody will ever know that we did them? That's the question. And it seems like a very live question, given the way that things are going in the world right now.
Okay, Simon, let's turn to Alone in Berlin. It's pursuing similar themes, right? But it's not as light as Jojo Rabbit, of course.
It really isn't. This is the story from a Hans Fallada novel that was turned into a film. I actually haven't seen the film, but I have read the book. The film came out 2016, stars Emma Thompson and Brendan Gleeson. It's supposed to be pretty good, but not fabulous.
Right.
The story itself and the novel is amazing, actually. It was written in 1947. I think it took a long time to be translated into English, but it had quite an impact when it was.
So tell us what it's about.
Yeah, well, it's the story of a German couple who begin a project of painstakingly writing postcards each night that have anti-Nazi slogans on them, encouraging people to resist. They have themselves lost their son in the war. He's been killed at the Eastern Front. And so they've slowly come to see the Nazi regime as evil and something they want to resist. The first postcard they ever wrote was, "Mothers, Hitler will kill your sons too." And so what happens is, the way the story goes, is he, after writing these postcards, wanders around the city each day, leaving these postcards in public places.
Which sounds really kind of discreet and little, but in the context of where they are, that's...
Yep.
Incredibly risky, right? I mean, you can imagine people are probably informing on their neighbours as well.
They were.
And if you're caught, there's no like, oh, you know, we'll let you off this time. And, you know, I can imagine as well that when it comes down to the decision of should we do this, I mean, I myself would imagine that I would be flooded with all these rationalizations. You know, why should I do this? What difference is it going to make? And if I get caught, what will have been achieved?
Yes, the futility of it is really... something that's prominent in the story, and as you read it, it's kind of pathetic in a way. Like, what possible difference does this make? The other thing about this novel is that none of the characters are particularly likable, and it's very deliberate, I believe. He's trying to make these people to be anything but heroic. They're not heroes, in a sense. They're people you don't even warm to particularly. But you do recognise that what they end up doing is hugely courageous. It's actually reckless behaviour. And there's something important about what they're doing. There's a moral universe in which they're operating. And you're left in no doubt on which side they sit.
Do you donate anything to the Führer?
Germany has taken my only son. For you, for the Führer. What more can a man donate than his child?
Otto, why are you writing like that?
I'm writing cards. Cards that tell the truth.
To who?
I don't know. People will read these cards. They were passed them on.
I'm coming with you. You can't stop me.
So, Simon, what are you left with after reading Alone in Berlin?
It's really beautifully constructed. I think it shows the characters who are the enthusiastic supporters of National Socialism. They're unrelentingly described as really ordinary, nondescript, unremarkable people who are really finding a place where they can look and feel important. So that they look pathetic, even the ones who have risen through the ranks and are kind of doing well in that regime. You also see how incredibly difficult it is to resist, how by 1940 there's such a comprehensive system of controlling people. Any sort of risk associated with kind of a form of resistance is really noticeable. And also the sort of futility of it. You just can't get away from the notion that there's something right in what they're doing, but it's not going to end well.
I have to admit, if I were ever in a situation like the one you describe, I hope I would have the courage of my convictions. I hope that I would do the right thing rather than simply the expedient thing. Because if I look back over my history, I wonder if I err more toward one rather than the other.
I'm sure many of us being confronted with this story feel the same way. You kind of feel conflicted. There's all sorts of moral and ethical challenges and puzzles in this work. I thought it was amazing, actually. Apparently the film's pretty good, so I'm disappointed that it wasn't great because it deserved a really good film for such a fabulous story. But as we've been told before, sometimes quite literary novels don't translate well to films. I think maybe that's what's happened here.
The third film we want to talk about today is the latest from Terrence Malick. It's called A Hidden Life, and it tells the story of Franz Jägerstätter, the Austrian peasant farmer who was imprisoned by the Nazis in 1943 for refusing to take an oath of allegiance to Hitler and the Nazi Party. The film takes on the story of Jägerstätter and his wife Franziska, or Fanny, as they try and grapple with this agonizing choice. Do they get into line like everyone else in their village, or do they listen to their conscience and do what they think is right, refuse to cooperate? In this case, it's a refusal to fight for the Nazis. But the cost of that choice is, as you'd imagine, extremely high.
Remember the day when we first met? I remember that motorcycle, my best dress. You looked at me, and I knew how simple life was then.
What's happened to our country?
Simon, this movie was one you found really affecting, if also a bit of an ordeal, and you wrote about it, and we'll of course include a link to that article in the show notes.
I really was affected by this. It's an ordeal in the sense that it's long.
Right.
Nearly 3 hours.
Okay.
But because the subject matter is so tense and you really feel like you've been through some of this torturous experience by the end of it. But in a sense, that can be great movie making. It does impact you. You think about it afterwards. You talk about it. You know, I'm still talking about it with my wife and, you know, other friends and so on. And it's beautiful. Like Malick's films, you've seen that.
Oh, they're amazing.
They're incredible.
Yeah.
Like the visuals, amazing. It's sort of inspiring in terms of that sort of visual impact. And so you see this family, the Jägerstätters, they're farming in Upper Austria. And it's, as you can imagine, the scenery is incredible.
The hills are alive.
It's all, especially in the first half of the film, it's all this farming. It made me feel completely lazy, like I don't do anything. It's all this sort of chopping and milking and, you know, threshing, whatever they do. And it's definitely a sense of a kind of family together in this idyllic scene. It's like the Garden of Eden. But you see this very effectively. The clouds are building in the valley, you know, war's coming to their country, and you know that something very serious is about to happen.
I can't swear loyalty to Hitler. I can't.
Do you think your defiance will change the course of things?
If God gives us free will, we're responsible for what we do, what we fail to do.
And we know that he's going to resist the Nazis to great cost to himself. And yet, the way that the story unfolds, it takes you through this whole process of making that decision, right? So it seems to walk you through the complexity of it all. And maybe that's what the film's trying to do, that to show you that it's a counterintuitive decision, but one that's absolutely important.
Yeah, it's worth remembering that Franz, the father, you know, the husband in this story, he has no romantic notions that by resisting in the way that he does, that's going to change things in his village or in his country or change the course of the war. There's none of that. But for him, it's just a personal choice, this stand that he takes that he knows will cost him enormously. It'll cost his wife enormously. It's going to change their lives irrevocably. He just can't do anything other than this, which is fascinating because everyone else is falling into line and getting behind the Nazi push. And he, for whatever reason, he just can't do it. One person says, just say the oath, but don't mean it in your heart. And he says, God will know what you mean. And he's, it's a bit like, and I think Terrence Malick is known for this. I'm sure he reads the book of Job a lot in the Old Testament. It's a bit like that. Job in the Old Testament has this kind of all these terrible things happening to him. And his accusers, his supposed friends, are constantly at him, telling him to do something other than what he thinks he should do and or feel differently from how he feels. But in this case, Jägerstätter says, you know, despite everyone else's opinion, I have to stand on my conscience. I cannot serve this evil regime. Jägerstätter was disillusioned by his church that he saw had capitulated to the Nazis. They'd chosen the institution over what's true to the faith, and it was whether it was through fear or expediency or whatever.
But there were some individual priests, right, who did stand out from the crowd.
Yeah, there were. In his life, in Franz's life, there'd been a priest from his village, Joseph Karabath, who in 1940 he'd preached an anti-Nazi sermon and ended up getting sent to jail for this, and then was banished from the district. And he has some interaction with him in the film. He was quite an inspiration, as was another priest, Franz Reinisch, who terribly was executed for his refusal to swear allegiance to Hitler. And Franz Jägerstätter took great comfort and inspiration from these two people.
This idea of standing up for what you believe is right, even if it means going against everyone else, was something that Alyssa Wilkinson wrote about in her review of A Hidden Life. So I asked her about that aspect of Franz's story too.
It was so compelling that he was willing to give up this pastoral paradise that he's living in. And his wife, you know, supports him with that. And I talked to the actress who plays his wife for a while about it, and she said she discovered in her research that family was kind of ostracized in that village for a long time afterwards, that there was the feeling that he really had betrayed them in some way, which is maybe counterintuitive, but it kind of goes to show that there was a big cost for them, and it took decades for his image to be rehabilitated. I mean, it was actually true what happens in the movie. People keep saying, nobody's going to remember you, why are you going to do this, this isn't going to matter. And of course it matters, but the big question that movie poses is it good and right to do, you know, an act like he does, refusing to say he's loyal to a dictator, if that, you know, won't be known, if you're not going to be trumpeted as a hero necessarily. And that's really challenging, I think, because I think we're so used to these stories being stories of people who are called heroes, who get, you know, parades, or they get a movie made about them. And in this case, a movie was made, but it's, you know, it's certainly not not your average Hollywood depiction of a hero during World War II.
Yeah, and I think, I guess ordinary people like myself sometimes rest on our laurels and say, oh, well, we're not heroes. But that's exactly the point this film's trying to make, though, right?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And I think that's also what I love about that movie, is that very few people know the name of these characters. You know, he's been recognized and canonized, but he's still not a character that we definitely know their name and walk around talking about their heroism. This is a small story that's only kind of being, brought to light now. And we're ordinary people too, and like, we might be asked to do those kinds of things, and will we be brave enough to do them, even if we think nobody will ever know that we did them? That's the question. And it seems like a very live question, given the way that things are going in the world right now.
Mike Frost is a writer and speaker and has written a brilliant article on Terrence Malick. It's called The Gospel According to Terry. Mike's a bit of a film buff. He's loved Terrence Malick since he was 17, so we thought it'd be good to get him on the line to give us a perspective on A Hidden Life. Mike Frost, thanks for speaking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Now, let's talk about A Hidden Life. You and I have both seen it and both enjoyed it. Enjoy is the right word.
Enjoy it, the right word.
I think appreciated it or was struck by it. Yeah. What sort of impact did it have on you watching that film?
I sobbed actually toward the end. I mean, again, if anyone is interested in getting to know Terrence Malick, this is a pretty good picture to start with, because the narrative plot is much clear near the front of the film. Yeah.
Do you get this sense, as I did, that he's challenging audiences to think about the complexity of this sort of ethical choice, and the fact that Jägerstätter situates himself in this story that means things matter into eternity? Otherwise, it seems like a completely crazy decision.
Yeah. Well, and in fact, I mean, the title, A Hidden Life, and then that's explained with a quote at the end of the film, which talks about where the true power of the world is found. It's in the hidden life, or in the, I can't remember the quote now, but in the, those hidden lives, or those lives, you know, unremembered in the age to come. In other words, and this is often echoed in the film, lots of people, when they're trying to convince him to sign the oath, they say to him, this is going to make no difference what you're doing. This doesn't. No one cares what you're doing. You're an unknown person. Why are you doing this? And in a sense, what I think Malick is saying is he's not doing it in order to be seen or known. He's not doing it as like, hey, look at me. Look what I'm showing you another way. He's doing it because he's following the way of grace. There's some greater story that's been told before him and will continue to be told after him. It doesn't matter to him that his life is a hidden life. His choice, he's compelled by his entry into or his involvement in this ongoing bigger story, a story bigger than him or any decision that he's making. And look, if you don't mind me saying, I think it is also a very, very Christian film. Not only is he a Christian man who's refusing to sign this oath, but I think it kind of mirrors the Christian story. Because if you remember, Simon, it begins with this newsreel footage of Adolf Hitler and the Nuremberg rallies. And so it begins with this descent into the hell of Nazism. And then immediately after that, we go to this kind of alpine paradise where the Jägerstatters, the couple at the center of the film, are living. And it feels like heaven, like you go up into the mountains. It's in the clouds, literally in the clouds. Mm. They're living there. Their life seems idyllic, and you see this complete harmony with nature as they, you see all the seasons, winter and spring and summer unfold. He has three snowy-haired, gorgeous little children. It feels like we get a glimpse of hell, and then we go up to heaven, and we see this kind of perfect realm. And then this one man chooses to leave heaven, to go down into the hell, as it were, in order to be an example to this cruel and vicious and broken world of another way. Well, I don't want to get preachy or anything here, but it sounds a lot like, you know, Christ coming from on high to be an image, an example, a vision of light in the midst of darkness. In many respects, I think Franz Jägerstatter, the lead character in this film, is a Christ figure, and it's magnificently told.
This has been Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity with me, Simon Smart, and with Justine Toe.
Thanks to Alyssa Wilkinson and Mike Frost for making time to speak with us about these movies. Of course, we'll link to all the articles we've mentioned in this episode in our show notes. That's reviews from Alyssa, as well as Mike's article, and also Simon's article on A Hidden Life as well.
Next week.
I guess the most worrying time for me in the refuge was when I was in the first aid station and the CFA person in charge came in to speak to the first aid people and said, look, this isn't likely to happen, but if we can't protect this building, for example, if the water tankers, if the fire trucks run out of water, you'll need to go through that door down to the water. You've got 600 people, lots of children, and that door was about a metre wide. That was not going to be a pretty sight.